Hey, welcome back. This is Ron Greenfield of Aspects of Entertainment, and you're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Well, hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener. And welcome to episode 22 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, which you can find on iTunes and your fancy podcast app on iPhone 6 and I think the Droid, too. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that attempt to find the culture in pop culture. I want to thank everybody for downloading, listening, recording, and all the great feedback on the interview last week with Simone Bailey. People really took to that, especially some in terms of directing and table reads and all that kind of stuff. So really glad that crossover was insightful. And I want to thank all the Stargate SG-1 fans for not crucifying me on the internet. One of the hardest things about doing the show is trying to fit some really impressive resumes into a very short period of time. We could fill the hour with what my guest this week has done. Mr. M. Dal Walton III was a production executive in charge of just a whole litany. You'll see on the, I click on his IMDb link, just a whole litany of great movies, including Narc, Once Fallen with Ed Harris, one of my favorites, 16 Blocks with Bruce Willis, and I think the highly underrated Righteous Kill with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. If you didn't like it the first time you saw it, I recommend revisiting it. He also did some work in the world of management and is now working as a producer and screenwriter. Mr. M. Dal Walton III, welcome to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Why, thank you.
So, I do want to talk about this evolution of your career because it's there's such a I think reinventing yourself is a necessary thing in the world of entertainment. However, we got to start with the fact that you are a production executive because I think for many people, I know, you know, for me, the film school I went to, and you hear just numerous stories about the executive. And it's almost like a four-letter word for some people. And yet, I think that sometimes is true, but I think there's kind of a bad rap that executives, creative executives, production executive gets as far as being the people who just want to facilitate and make a good movie. And they're sometimes the folks in charge who have to deliver sometimes not welcome news or sometimes reality, but are actually there to help out and make sure the thing comes together. Does that all make sense?
No, it makes total sense. I mean, my opinion always has been the reason that production executives get a bad rap is because there are a few of them that deserve that. Mm-hmm. We kind of all get that. I mean, I've worked, you know, with guys that I was like, I don't think you know what you're talking about. And I've also worked with guys that, you know, that were, you know, brilliant. You know, I've certainly met my share of absolute geniuses in this business. And, you know, I mean, there's certainly people that become production executives that, you know, I feel bad for the writers, you know. And it's also a tough position because certainly there's a few levels of production executive, but at all of those levels you're reporting to somebody. So somebody's calling you up and be like, "Okay, we need helicopters in everything."
Right.
Really? Is that what we need? And you know, and that's the kind of note that I would get because a lot of our movies had an international financing, and so they'd be like, we need, you know, every reel has to have an action beat in it. We need helicopters. We need, you know, hand-to-hand combat. We need gunplay. Every single reel, which is every 6 minutes, you know, back in the day as a film. You know, and so it's you get handed that sort of edict, and you're like, okay, how do I make this work? And by the way, I have to deliver this, you know, edict, you know, to the writer. And be like, okay, we got to make this work.
Right.
You know, I think it's, you know, it's tough because as a writer, I could say that, you know, I do my work alone in a room with like one light bulb, you know, and I don't mean that in a romantic sort of way, but I mean that in the sort of like, I don't need, you know, a lot of stuff around me or people talking or anything like that. But, you know, the development process is the opposite of that. It's a whole bunch of people all sitting around talking about something, you know, and you, the writer, or me, the production, you know, now that I'm on the writing side, you know, my job is to take in all of that stuff and, you know, then try to make sense of it. And then, you know, morph my baby into, you know, a hybrid of what I dreamed my baby would be and the, you know, edicts that came down from way up upon the mount.
is it kind of a job, like, is one of the jobs of a, because kind of my question is, like, what exactly does a production executive do? Because it sounds like one of the jobs is almost running interference from on high.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. I mean, I always describe my job, and I was, at the end of my time at Emmett Furlough Films, I was, the executive vice president. And my job was to do all of the things that, needed to get done, that if it was your company and you were the guy making the final decisions, that you wouldn't want to have to do on a day-to-day basis, or just did not have the time to, which meant that, it was my job to check in with the writer to make sure they're actually doing what they said they would do on the timeline they said they would do it on, And if they have problems, then it's my job to try to make those problems go away. If they've run into a plot problem, like, it doesn't make sense, I can't do it, There's no reason that those two should ever date. Okay, we need to figure this out because they got a date by the third act. Right. So yeah, it's absolutely my job is a what I believed as a production executive was a problem solver. And I think that the my philosophy as a production executive, as it pertains directly to writers, is my job was to take all of the information that I was given from the guys who signed my checks and who I worked for, and take, what they wanted as their final result, and then not necessarily hand, this is how I tried to work, and, I'm not making generalization now, this is not my, and I tried never to hand that off to the writers, because then I'm trying to cram something down their throats.
Right.
So my job was ask as many questions as possible to get to the result that we ultimately wanted. And that wasn't because I was trying to play some sort of mumbo jumbo psychological mind trick on anybody, but it's because I know that every writer has a ton of their own ideas. I've been through the writing process myself. I can say that there's a million ideas come up and I throw away a lot of them along the way. So my job as a production executive was to ask questions about maybe some of the ideas that got tossed, maybe we could use now.
Yeah.
Or maybe by challenging the writer with a series of questions, we could get to a movie that everybody loved.
Well, it reminds me of stories we've heard from directors on the show about, like, trying to convince the actor that the note is their idea. And I've had actors tell me that that's how they like to work, because I kind of agree with that as a writer, is like, because I've gotten the notes sometimes and I'm like, I don't see it. And sometimes through a conversation like that, it's like, oh, now I see what you mean. So I like, does that kind of ring true? Like, is it almost like trying to get, like, if you just, like, I see what you mean. Like, if you just say, hey, they've got to hook up by act three, so make it so. I mean, that's a tricky thing to do. But asking the questions until they see it themselves, that seems like almost more of a collaboration.
Oh, yeah. No. I believe that. That the production executive's job, or specifically the development executive, my job is to bring out the absolute best movie in the writer, and that may mean that there's some parameters for what we define as best, but it's absolutely to do that. And I think that if I tell someone something, we need that boy meets girl to be making out by the third act, then I haven't helped them make the best movie possible, because
right.
I've said what the end result must be, which kind of doesn't help us get there. And I know that writing is a journey, much like acting is a journey, So I threw something at them and said, okay, now we need to do this. And the writing process isn't that way.
Right.
I can't pretend it's that way because I want a result. The writing process is, I have a character, and I've always believed it's all, for me, writing, and even as a development guy, it's about the characters. So where do they start that's going to make them end up hooking up with her at the end of somewhere in the act three? So where are they the 10 minutes before the movie started? So that when the movie starts, it's destiny, because that's what we're trying to create. From a totally creative macro perspective. So my job then is to say, okay, let's talk about the 10 minutes before the movie started, where our viewers tune into the lives of these characters. Where were they? What were they doing?
Mm.
And what do they want? And what's their lie? okay, let's figure out these questions. And we start figuring out these questions, and we start answering them, and then we can figure out that some of the answers make sense to get us where we, you know, in the movie we're trying to do. You know, I mean, the most important question you can always ask when before you, you know, as a guy who was a producer picking movies is, why this movie? Why are we doing this?
Right. The one of the things that you often hear, and I think it's a misnomer, and I'm not saying that in any sort of like suck up kind of way, because the more executives I talk to, the more creative they are. Like, I think there's this misunderstanding of, oh, here comes the studio exec. Uh-oh, here comes the exec. And they're all about money, 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 money. What's the bottom line? What's the money? But my experience, and the more I talk to folks who have been in your position, it actually sounds like the production executive is actually the bridge between the creatives and the people with the money, and sort of the translator between both worlds. Would you say that's an accurate assessment? Or if it's not, how am I wrong? You know?
No, I would say that's accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, and I would say that not necessarily 100% of the time is that the case, because it's going to vary on the skill level of whoever the development executive is. You
sure.
know, just like the, you know, but I think absolutely that their job is to facilitate creatively the stuff in black and white is the best possible thing that can get handed to a director or handed to a writer, or excuse me, handed to an actor.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was always my goal. Like, I want the best script so that when this script goes out to directors, every director in Hollywood goes, holy cow, why am I not doing this movie already?
Exactly. And I think there's something like, I mean, look, there's many famous fights and many famous wars that have happened between the creatives and the studios and things like that. But at the same time, I mean, you know, there is a reality that, and I don't think writers and directors and people should necessarily stress themselves out about it too much, but it is a business. If there's no box office, if nobody's going to go see it, you know, these are realities that we have to exist in. And I
Absolutely.
Think I think it's something that people need to bear in mind and not necessarily look at the folks who are, because some of the most creative and inventive and wonderful movies that have come out recently, especially in the past 5, 6, 7 years, I think it's been we're like in a new golden age of movies. You know, when friends of mine who love comic book movies can go and see every comic book movie in the world over the summer, and then I'm going to see Birdman and Foxcatcher and things like that. You know, we're getting the best of all worlds. But all those movies do have to make money. They do have to appeal to a paying audience, and we have to sort of remember that. It kind of speaks to your point about why this movie. Because if you can't answer that, is anybody even going to go see it?
Yeah, I mean, it is unfortunate that part of the question, or not a part of the question, but a separate question that is asked by the studios is, can I sell it?
Sure.
You know, I mean, there's a reason why Disney writes billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar checks for a couple of very specific companies, you know, recently. You know, because the answer is, can I sell it, is resoundingly hell yes.
Yeah. And yeah, then reality comes along.
Yeah, absolutely.
With certain things. You've done, looking at a lot of these movies, you seem to be gravitating towards, when you were with Emmett Furlow Films, I'm not trying to generalize here, but some really gritty stuff. You know, some of the movies that we talked about, when you look at Narc, Righteous Kill, 88 Minutes, the sort of drama. But the dramas over the past, I feel like dramas in cinema have kind of been challenged by the fact that so many gritty dramas are going on to television. Were you noticing that at the time when you were in charge of some of these movies, or were you not really genre specific? You were looking for the whatever scripts were working.
Well, I think to answer your question, I think that because a lot of our financing when I was at Emmett Furlow was internationally derived,
mm-hmm.
You know, specifically that's the action genre, for lack of a better way of describing it, and I'm going to give a caveat here, is it travels very well. It translates into any language mm-hmm. because you know, an explosion looks like an explosion no matter where you're from. And a hero's arc is a hero's arc and has been that way for thousands of years. So, as a sort of macro, like, okay, we're going there, but in order to make that movie in the, you know, the 90s and then early 2000s, you know, it couldn't have been what it was in the 80s. It needed to be something a little more interesting. You need to have thriller elements in it. You know, we were, you know, in a new sort of era of movies, you know, we'd already seen, you know, some of the seminal movies, you know, like, that were thrillers. And so that came out of the independent world. That came out of the independent world. That, you know, and I think Narc is an example of the kind of thing that had a lot of violence and gritty and action stuff in it. But, you know, you got to solve it kind of question, you know, as much as, you know, what was, you know, as Reservoir Dogs was, you got to pay attention because, like, I'm not sure how it's all going to work out. You know, I mean, like, it all doesn't look great and not everybody's telling the truth and Usual Suspects and Memento and movies like that where you're like, you needed that had, you know, very sort of thriller-esque elements. I won't even necessarily say action, although you had a bunch of heavies, you know, walking around in Usual Suspects, so you felt that you were imminently in the presence of violence, even if you didn't necessarily have on-screen violence. Right. And I think that, you know, in the independent world, you're trying to get people to do movies, and I mean people, I mean actors, to do a movie for not on a studio budget. I mean, the actors that we work with, I mean, Righteous Kill is a perfect example of two Oscar winners, you know. You have to bring them something that they haven't seen before that's going to interest them, that they're not going to get able to be paid the way that they, you know, that they got paid for Analyze That, you know,
or,
you know, stuff like that. I mean, it just doesn't happen in the independent world. We can't afford the kind of budgets and because the even the whole financing model is different from the studio model. It's just not possible to do what they do because they own, you know, companies that are in France and in all, you know, a myriad of different countries. They can do certain things with their business model that independently you don't do. You just can't. It's not possible. So you have to come up with a way to attract these talent without just making it about dollars and cents for them. And we did that by having what you described as gritty, you know, movies, you know, that had this sort of a dramatic element on thrillers, on action, on all of that sort of stuff that was kind of like that. So the actor was like, okay, this is interesting. This isn't necessarily just a paycheck. This is something that I think could be really interesting to do.
Yeah.
You know, so, and we did that with, you know, movies that still had big budgets. You know, I say big, but still pales in comparison with what a studio budget is. But you know, for on the independent world, a $60 million movie is a big budget.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm going to be just a total fanboy here for a second because I love movies from the 70s. That's my golden age of cinema. And like that was that list of movies you talk about. Like you could put Narc against French Connection. You know what I mean? Like some of those good, like Usual Suspects too, and a lot of these movies are almost love letters to the 70s. Some of those 70s crime thrillers and things of that nature. But, like you pointed out here, the studios aren't making them anymore. Now it's the indies. And something that sort of drives me crazy is when I hear people say, oh, they'll never make that anymore, they'll never make that anymore. And I bring up some of these examples, and they're like, well, the studios aren't making them. And I'm kind of like, who cares? Because a guy who loves crime thrillers in Illinois – or Florida, or wherever, or international in Germany, who just loves this genre of movies, he's not going to care what the slate at the beginning of the movie says. As long as he's getting the movie he loves and the type of movie that he could just sink his teeth into, I think there's still opportunities there for some of this stuff, even if you can't go through the studios.
Oh yeah, there are absolutely, and let's be honest, the movies that make it into the theaters that are the genre that you're describing, 9 out of 10 times probably have a studio finger in the distribution.
Oh, booyah. Yep. read my mind. Absolutely.
You can't.
That's the
you
next
can't,
question.
I mean, there are 5 companies that can actually do real DVD distribution because they have the deals with Walmart and Target, who are, you know, more than the lion's share of the home video physical DVD market, you know, so. If, you know, there aren't a lot of companies that can do it because they're, you know, they're not vetted vendors. So they just can't go to Target and be like, hey, will you carry my DVD?
Right.
I made it. It's even if you were like, I got Al Pacino, they're like, I don't know who you are. Have Universal call us.
And what was the theatrical numbers? You know what I mean? What were your things? And if I didn't have distribution in the theater, you're going to have a lot harder time selling it on plastic.
Absolutely.
This may sound like a stupid question, but some of these movies that you guys were dealing with over at Emmett Furla, like, were they movies, or scripts rather, that let's say they had gone through the studio system, but the studio system said, we don't make movies like this anymore, or we don't think this is worth the investment, and then it comes across your desk, and you have to take it from like a $50 million movie down to like a 10. Was that something that you occurred a lot, or were you more like discovering new material out there?
No, that occurred a lot. I mean, specifically, The Wicker Man was a movie that got bought out of turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Cage with Neil LaBute. So, I mean, yeah, there were certainly movies that, you know, that we would, you know, I'm going to say pick up. That's not a technical term. But you pick it up from the studio because the studio is like, I don't really necessarily want to do that movie anymore, you know. And they had spent a bunch of money on it from an independent perspective. They had spent a ton of money on it in development. And then they just kind of like, no, we don't do it. Because for they look at the movie and they go, for us, that's like a $75, $85 million movie. We got to worry about P&A. So I'm at $100 million for a movie that, can I get $100 million back? Maybe. But wouldn't it be better to spend that $100 million as half of a $200 million budget and know that I can make $1 billion? Oh, yeah, I like that math better. But on the independent perspective, you're like, oh, okay, so you were going to spend 75. You know what? I'll do it for 35, you know, because it's a movie that the creative people still care about. Nick Cage still cares about. Neil LaBute still would love to do this movie. Okay, let's figure out a way to make it work.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm a stupid optimist, but I'm just not cynical. And whenever I read something cynical about the business, I just don't really buy into it. You know, I'll always remember Ewan McGregor did a theater, like a 12-week engagement on the West End for like £300 a week. And somebody said, how could you do it for this little money? And he's like, I already made my money with Star Wars. I want to do this play. And I think that just because people bemoan the fact that oh, it's all $100 million, billion-dollar movies, no, there's still avenues to find things and to still make these great movies and to still find it. And especially in the digital age now, it's almost like a revolution.
I will say this.
Temper my enthusiasm. Go ahead.
And no, this is in support of your Ewan McGregor sort of analogy there. Actors at all levels of the game, by and large, still love to act. They want to do that. They want to find a character that is fucked up, and they want to live in the skin of that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to find somebody that goes from picking up trash to being the hero at the end of the movie. They still want to do all of those sorts of things that they got into the business when they were in their 20s to do. They've become, and in many cases, they've become a big industry. You know, they're paying the salaries of lots of people through their commissions, mm-hmm. through the, you know, all that sort of stuff. So sometimes it becomes harder to get Ewan McGregor to do a smaller movie because of the business around him. Not because of him. And I'm not picking on Ewan McGregor by any stretch of the imagination. He's done tiny movies as well as the West End example you just gave. So he is not one of those people. But sometimes, as a producer, you got to work harder to get that script into their hands.
Right.
You know, I mean, we all have heard the St. Vincent story about how hard it was to get the script in the hands of Bill Murray. And Bill Murray's made a thorough effort to not have an industry around him.
And still, it's the walls
and,
are up.
You know, and still, you know, you have to, as a filmmaker, and I'm going to lump directors and writers and producers into that category of filmmakers. If you know, you want a piece of talent, you know, that's just perfect for this role, and I know that they would just love this role. You have to be willing to knock and 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 knock on the door. You know, because, you know, sometimes the door is just not going to open, you know, because it's the wrong day, you know, and so you have to be persistent, you know, in chasing that goal, you know, because then sometimes you're going to call up the agent and go like, nope, needs a payday. Sorry. Nah, he doesn't need a payday, but that's the line they're giving out that day, you know, because they have a job to do too, you know, and they're, you know, they get paid when their client gets paid and they want the best for their client. In all terms, they equally balance out creative with financial, you know, equally balance it out in their mind. So, you know, you've got to be like, okay, let's see if we can get the script. Let's try, you know, oh, I don't know. We'll send it to them. Maybe, I don't know. you know, work to get it into their hands, and you can get it into their hands, and then, you know, then the material back to the development executive, it either speaks to the artist or it doesn't.
Right.
And if it doesn't, okay, they probably weren't the right person for the movie anyway, no matter what you thought.
And is there, like, another reason to knock, too, a lot of times, is the business changes all the time. Deals fall through. This happens here. This happens there. And all of a sudden, when they're in June saying, no way, under no circumstances, don't call me again, they may have three or four deals fall through and want something for award season. And when you call in November, where you been? I've been waiting for you. You know?
Oh yeah. No, timing is a huge, 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 huge thing. You know, it you know, I've been on both sides of that as you know, on the producing side where it worked to your advantage and they're like, okay, can you be ready in 3 weeks? And you're like, it was an 8 week prep.
Yeah.
Yeah. But how about, can you do it in three? 'Cause he's ready in three. If you're ready in three,
right.
And it's like, okay, I guess we'll be ready in three. You know, we'll spend eight weeks worth of money in 3 weeks. And, you know, then the director says, it's impossible, I can't do it. And then you go, okay, we have to solve these problems because he's ready to go. And I've been on the other side where there's like, yeah, that movie's running long. And then he's got another one. So I don't think that window's there anymore.
Right.
You're like, oh, no.
And you basically just answered why, you know, for those of you out there who are watching a movie going, I wonder, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do this? They ran out of time and they ran out of money. That's it. Mm-hmm. That answers every question for every movie asked that
with, you know, any actor whose name you actually know, scheduling is in fact an issue. It really is. I mean, because they have lives, they have family obligations, they have other stuff. And so you're like, hey, let's go live in Vancouver for 3 or 4 months. Well, you're not the only person who says, let's go live somewhere for 3 or 4 months and make a movie. Somebody else says, let's go to Morocco for 3 or 4 months and make a movie. And they're like, I'm already at 8 months of not being home. You know, scheduling is a real thing. You know,
looking at just a few examples, I know he's a four-letter word, but I cannot believe Mel Gibson shot We Were Soldiers in the afternoon and Signs in the morning. And like Michael J. Fox, Back to the Future and Family Ties at the same time. That's punishing. That is a punishing, punishing schedule. Whatever anybody thinks of the craft of acting, that is not easy at all. Before we move on to other stuff, let's talk about being a production exec. Let's ask, you know, these are kind of general questions, but like, what are some of the big mistakes? I think sometimes, you know, a writer, especially a first-time writer or somebody who's not super experienced, is going to be kind of terrified of working with executives and working, even in a small production company, you know, even in an indie, may actually be very afraid and sort of worried about, oh God, are they going to ruin my script? Am I going to have to go against principle? What sort of advice do you have for that writer as far as like good things to do and even like bad things to avoid?
Well, what I'll say is I wish that didn't exist, mm-hmm. the question you just asked.
Yeah, no, sorry.
because it furthers in the mind of the writer that what's going to happen is bad.
Mm.
And, you know, it already colors the pallor of the entire experience. And every writer coming out of film school has that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So they're immediately resistant to even the most brilliant of notes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I've ever been a guy who gave out brilliant notes, but, the real goal of the development executive is to make the best possible script, which is always beyond the grasp of either the development executive or the writer at the moment the process begins. The best thing that this script could be doesn't exist yet. Sure, there's a few examples of scripts that were written in, you know, one sitting that went on to win an Oscar. You know, we know those stories because they're so rare.
I'm dubious, too, of all of them.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and let's be honest. In a significant, although maybe not majority portion of it, the guy who stands up there and accepts the Oscar for best screenplay, original screenplay, may not have had 100% of the words on the page.
I'm tempted to. People can Google that if they want. I'm a big fan of the movie Good Will Hunting, but we're going to move on.
I wasn't even thinking on that particular
story.
Example,
no,
but I could say that, you know, I mean, a director starts to tinker with things, you know, unless they've had a really long, long, long relationship with one particular writer where they just talk the same language, and which means the writer got the note before the note was given because he's like, I know what, you know, I know what he wants. I get it. I get it. We're going there. Okay.
Yeah, I bring up. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to bring up. I only bring up Goodwill Hunting because that's an open secret. You could read about it in Goldman's second book. Yeah, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on this one, but a recent example is the 12 Years a Slave. A lot of controversy about that and big dispute between the writer and director, but that's a reality of the business, and hopefully that gets resolved and more great movies come out from those guys who are, each one of them, whatever side you're on, is super talented. And I do think you're right, and I think it's one of those things where, like, even whether it's from a production executive, Dow, or a producer or a director, or even, like, your girlfriend or your dad or your uncle or whoever is like, why did you do this? Like, notes suck. Every writer hates getting notes. I don't know of any writer who is like, I cannot wait to get notes. But at the same time, it's like taking bad medicine. Learning how to take them and learning how they can help and learning how they can absolutely make your script better is a big part of the process. I don't think it's unique.
I want to break the analogy. You said bad medicine. It doesn't
or good medicine.
Bad medicine.
Bad tasting medicine. That's good for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's bad tasting because it's scary.
Mm.
You know, and I would argue that the reason so many people don't become professional writers, as in I got paid for doing what I love to do, is because they are afraid. Oh, they're going to ruin my baby. Well, you know what? That's like saying I'm not sending my kid to kindergarten because they're going to ruin him. Mm. Well, you're going to pick up swear words at school. That's just what happens. However, you're going to learn to read and write. Might even learn to get along with other people. You know, I mean, I get it. I mean, as a writer, you know, when someone gives me notes, you know, the deep dark child in me goes cringe because I'm afraid. I'm afraid that they could be right and I could be wrong. And life is not black and white, and scripts are not black and white. There is no right or wrong solution. But I could be afraid that they're saying something to me that I hadn't thought of. Mm-hmm. When I've spent, you know, and you know, most screenplays, if you crank out one finished screenplay a year, you are a frickin' amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I know Oscar winners who had teams of people working under them for the scripts that they cranked out. You know, like, yeah, they like little researchers and whatnots, you know, like, okay, whatever, you know. But so if you're a person working alone in a dark room, you know, you could finish off one, like, from start to finish screenplay in a year. That's, and do that consistently. That is significant. That's my opinion, by the way.
No, I think it's
of a full feature screenplay. So if you've spent a year thinking about these characters in this world, and then someone comes up to you and goes, I wonder what it would be like if the guy was the girl and the girl was the guy. Hmm. And you as the writer go, well, it wouldn't be like anything because it just wouldn't happen. And then you go home and you think, what am I saying about men and women in these two roles? And what if I made them the opposite sex? Then what would I be saying about men and women in this movie? And then after about a week, you go, oh shit. Oh man, that is totally misogynistic. That is totally sexist. That is totally blah, 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 blah. Wow. Holy crap. And then like an entire year's worth of being alone with these characters just melts away. But in the best of all circumstances, it melts away and it is magic. All of a sudden, the things that by the end of that year had bound you up as a writer, bound me up as a writer, all of a sudden you're like, oh, 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 they're gone. I changed one thing and they're gone. The plot is loose again. The story moves quickly again. All the things that I was afraid of these notes because I had built this house of cards. Now all of a sudden, you know, it's like a good roto-rooter because one thing changed. Everything's flowing again.
And that's part of how you
scary.
Get
scary.
It is scary.
Scary.
And I'm going to share my own scary experience in a second. But that goes back to your thing of how do you make the best possible. You know, that's part of the process there. The I was I used to hate getting notes down. I'm not here pointing fingers at other writers saying, oh, I always loved to get it. I used to get so defensive and so hurt and so like, oh no, I'm a terrible writer. Oh God, I suck. I shouldn't be doing this. And, you know, I think one of the things that I learned to absorb notes, and a lot of this came from my experience in reality TV, is you want to get the notes for screenwriters who are listening to this who are scared. One, listen to what Dal just said a couple times because it's important. He laid it down, and he's absolutely right. But also, like, who would you rather get the note from? The executive, the producer, or the audience? Because once the audience gives the notes, that's it. You don't get no second chance. The executive gives the note, you can rewrite and be part of that process and try it out and figure out what's going on and take that idea that you didn't think of and then make it better. And then all of a sudden, by the time it hits the screen, nobody remembers whose idea it was. And if somebody's running around the premiere going, well, you know, that was my idea, nobody's going to like that person anyway. So don't worry about that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Hey, you know what? Yeah, exactly. They're going to run around saying, oh, yeah, it was my bit. Yeah, exactly. Let them go ahead and keep saying that. It's still your name.
Yeah, and
on screen.
And if 19 people are running around saying it was their bit, then believe the 20th person who's silent.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think something else too you brought up and touched upon, and I want to repeat it for a second, is time. You know, a good friend, Steve Skye, who I interviewed recently, is a professional TV writer and producer. And every time he gives me notes, if he's kind enough to read my script, he always says to me, "Here's my notes. So take a look at them next week. You know, read them now, and then look at them next week, and we could talk about them." Because he knows, and you mentioned this, it takes a little time to process. Mm-hmm. Put it away for a second. Sleep on it. Don't call the person up and punch them in the face. Just take them, listen to them, I could tell stories all night, but like one time I got a note, I hated it. I was so mad. I was furious at this note. And 3 weeks into the rewrite, I was like, oh my God, I have to do that note. It's the best note I've gotten. It's absolutely right. Let's talk about how you segued from production executive into management. How did that come about?
It came about because I believe that there is, and it incorporates a lot of the things that we've kind of skirted around about what I'm going to call modern cinema, but really shouldn't say that because the internet and television, and there are whole companies that just crank out stuff that goes video on demand, which basically is the equivalent of the old, you know, direct-to-DVD companies.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You know, so if I put all of that into a big, bright cinema, I mean, let's be honest, True Detective was a freaking movie that just happened to be like a two-parter, you know?
Right.
I mean, like that was a real movie. Like if we watched that movie, we would all be like, best picture, you know? It just happened to be drawn out over, you know, hours, you know, 12 hours worth of stuff. So, I mean, if it was a movie, we'd be talking about The Godfather, you know, in the same sentence as True Detective, I think.
I can't agree with you more. Yeah, absolutely.
So if I lump all of that stuff into it, we can call it entertainment, but that word just sounds weird. I think that there's now possible, in ways that haven't been possible for a long, long time, for an artist to be, you know, captain of their own fate and master of their own destiny. Sure, at a certain point, there is a guard at the gate who's going to say, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
But in ways that never really happened before, you know, Sundance was the beginning of it, then Sundance became not really about it, but South by Southwest is becoming it, you know, Telluride is becoming it, you know, there's all those other sorts of places. There's a million film festivals. There are festivals that are only online. But the point that I'm making is we have the ability as artists to create content. And really that's what writers, directors, and actors want to do. We want to make something that didn't exist before this, and we want to show it to people in the most basic sense. That's what we want to do, you know? And I believe it's possible in ways that it wasn't possible before. You know, one of the things that was so phenomenal, and there were many evils, don't get me wrong, one of the things that was so great about the studio system is it allowed people to start out as nothing, you know, an extra, and work their way up as actors. They were there, they got to show up, punch a time card, get paid, not a lot, but get paid, to show up and do the things they wanted to do day after day after day. So they had the chance to hone their craft. So much of the big business of Hollywood, quote unquote, is not about honing your craft. It's about, you know, throwing the mantle of celebrity on someone because it sells and it's marketable and we can, you know, it gets covers of magazines and it gets, you know, entertainment type shows, you know. So I got into management because I'm like, okay, I think there's something in that that maybe I can be of use for, that I can, we'll call it management, but it's my helping out writers, directors, and actors to do that, to become captain of their own destiny and masters of their own fate. You know, let's make some stuff. Let's workshop some screenplays. Let's make shorts. Let's make a web series. Let's do all of the things that I can now go into Best Buy and buy the equipment for. Mm-hmm. I mean, good grief. When I was in college, you know, we had the video toaster and that was awesome technology. You know, I had big Beta SP machines, you know, to define editing, you know, at that level, you know. And I didn't go to a film school. But, you know, it's changed so much. I mean, like the project that I just finished on that I wrote and directed, I literally said to the actor that I was turning something over to the color timer. And he didn't know what a color timer was. And the reason he didn't know what a color timer is because he never really worked in film,
right?
Like film. So they don't have to time any of the color. There's a colorist and he does it in a digital machine. So there's no color timing. They didn't time, you know, there isn't that chemical process anymore. It's a digital process. And I think that's great too. I'm not being nostalgic. I'm saying that's wonderful because now a bunch of people can get together and say, all right, let's do this thing. And it's technologically possible in ways that it was never possible for so many, many, many years. And I believed that management could help facilitate that, that we could help build actors, writers, directors' careers by saying, let's do the things. Let's hone our craft. Let's get better at it. And the only way we can get better at it is by doing it. Instead of running around and auditioning for stuff or taking meetings and pitching stuff in the hope that we'll get the chance to write something or direct something or act in something, let's just go do some of those things. Let's hone that craft. If one of them catches off and somebody sees it, I mean, there are plenty of movies now that people, you know, they say, all right, let's take that. Let's make that into another movie. Let's take a short and let's make it into a movie. Let's take that, those guys doing that wacky web series and let's give them a television show.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens. That's not Hollywood lore. That happens consistently enough that one could talk about it as a business model. It doesn't happen every day, but you could talk about it as like, okay, that's how I aim for catching lightning in a bottle. I aim for that. And I aim for that by being really, really busy and productive in doing the thing that I want to do as the end result, but I got to practice it as the road there.
I think you just summed up what 2014 and 2015 is all about. I just want to put that on a pillow or something. That was awesome. And, you know, a great example of that is like Adult Swim on Comedy Central. Or Comedy mm-hmm. Central and Cartoon Network are two examples of people who have gotten stuff made. And the South Park was made by that little short of Santa Claus versus Jesus. And it's like, who are these guys?
Yeah. I remember it.
How crazy was that?
I was here in Hollywood when it was passed around on VHS tape.
Yeah.
People don't remember that. I'm like, they're like, oh, yeah, it was the short. I'm like, it was passed around because it got dubbed on VHS cassettes.
Yeah.
And that people handed to each other 100, 1,000 times dubbing VHS. They weren't burning DVDs on their computers. They were dubbing it on VHS.
I saw it in Boston. And, like, it was one of those things, we watched it late night after a couple of adult beverages, mm-hmm. and, like, this guy pulls out this VHS and says, a friend of mine from Hollywood, you can't tell anybody about this video. This is top secret. You know, that's how we watch it. And it's not like that anymore. Now you go on YouTube and you put it on Facebook and it's everywhere. And
absolutely.
I think that's absolutely wonderful. But what I want to touch upon real quick about what you mentioned, and this is for the screenwriters out there, you know, I've been to Austin a few times and I talked to a lot of writers. And the question that constantly comes up, and even I asked this for a long time, is like, how do you find voice? How do you find your voice? And it's only by writing. And I think that's true about what you were saying with being busy and being a director. If you're a director, don't wait until Harvey Weinstein gives you $500 million, because chances are he's not, unless you got something to show him. So get to it.
I would also add this to how you find your voice, and I only say this because this is my experience, because it's been the path of my career. Read every screenplay mm-hmm. you can get your hands on. The internet is rife with amazing ones. This town is rife with horrible ones. Read all of them, from the first page to the last page. I think it is so important. You know, I mean, Stephen King will tell you this. If you're going to be writing, be reading.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think it is so important that so many people get caught up as writers, and, you know, and I'm guilty, too, of just focusing on, like, I need to write my own stuff. Yes, that's absolutely true. But one of the ways to learn about my own craft is by reading what someone else has done, whether it be good or whether it be bad. I mean, sometimes I've read stuff, because one of the things as a development executive is, you know, we talked about the part where we actually got a screenplay that I was developing, but most of the job is reading things and going, oh no, we will not be developing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not because of taste or anything, but there's a lot of, you know, I mean, and I have said this as a manager to my clients. I'm like, well, you just can't do that. That's not something that as a reader I want to see. I get that that's a style thing. I get it. And, you know, when you're Quentin Tarantino, do it. However, until you earn the right to be Quentin Tarantino, play by the rules.
Now, I know you don't want to bring up, I'm not asking to bring up any specific kind of cases, but do you mean like sort of format shattering stuff, like overwriting, over description? I mean, can you give us an idea of what you mean of like,
yeah, no, over description? And I'll tell you what, and this is speaking for myself, and mm-hmm. it make me sound horrible, but as a reader, and even to this day, it drives me bonkers when the writer talks to me, the reader.
Oh, don't. Well, you're gonna love my scripts. I hate that too.
Don't talk to me, because if you talk to me, then you've taken me out of the journey that I'm supposed to be in. You know, I'm supposed to be, when I'm reading, as a development exec, when I'm reading your script, I am supposed to be watching your movie in its best of all possible scenarios. Everything is perfect because it's only what I see in my head. And when the writer talks to me, then I stop that movie and listen to the writer talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I gotta restart that movie. So it takes me out of it. And I'm like, ugh. So as a development person, that drove me bonkers. And I, even as a manager, like, don't talk to the reader. Let them watch your movie.
There's a lot of debate about some of this stuff, like we see, we do, we go, you know, stuff like that. And I found that every time I talk to a writer, somebody says, you don't need that, I find myself using it less and less. And one of the things I love about reading scripts, just to back up your point here for a second, is the thing that I learned the most from reading scripts is it actually taught me what I don't need, what I don't have to do as a writer. Because yeah. what you see in so many, and read the great scripts. I mean, read all the Oscar-winning stuff. You will see stuff that's just like I could not believe how sparse the Alien scripts were. And it's like, yeah. you don't need anything else. You know, a spaceship flows through space. Okay, I'm done. Got it.
Yeah, you know? This is the other thing that you're 100% right, and I've said this to clients, and I said this as even as a development executive. You don't need to direct a movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy who will get paid to do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely
so
right.
Do all of the other things. Give me the most amazing, deep, multidimensional characters that you can in the most amazing world that you can dream up. But let the director direct it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One thing, though, just to clarify something real quick, and talking about being a manager, one thing that I think a lot of folks may not understand, I'm actually still wrapping my head around it too, is the difference between a manager and an agent. And a manager, you know, the way you're talking about producing and being involved, a manager is much more, or you know, jump in if I'm wrong here, like much more hands-on and is actually taking on more and more these days a much more producer role. With writers and talents and stuff.
Yeah, specifically with writers, I believe that your manager is your secret partner, for mm-hmm. lack of a better way of describing it. And speaking as a writer, I can say that I believe my manager would be my secret partner. they're the person that I'm going to show the screenplay to when I'm not sure if I'm done yet.
Mm.
And I need to talk to someone who's going to give me a wholly separate perspective on it, with nothing to gain but the knowledge that I'm going to sell the best possible script possible. And so, you know, that's the way I look at it. And when I was a manager, I firmly believe that my job was to help my clients become the best possible writers they could become. And so it was about asking the questions, okay, what does that mean? What do you mean? What is it? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? You know, so that the writer would take the time to like, okay, all right, let me go take that week and think about it. You know, and I believe that, and that the manager's job, specifically when you're talking about writers, is to be like, okay, let's make sure this is the best, because once you give it out, you know, to an agent who's really, you know, which is not to say they're not a collaborator, but they really are a salesman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they have a lot of clients. Managers should not have a lot of clients. If you have a manager who has a lot of clients, he's not doing his job. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong. But good odds are that manager is doing the same thing that an agent does, and that's not what they're supposed to do. A manager is supposed to be your, you know, silent partner, for lack of a better way, in the development of your career. You should have a manager for all of your life. You should have an agent until they don't do what you need them to do.
Mm.
You know, it's like a real estate agent. They didn't sell the house. I'm getting a new one.
I think that's a great point. Like I said, I'm sort of wrapping my head around this now, because I think, you know, going to Austin, the number one question on every screenwriter's mind is, how do I get an agent? How do I get an agent? And I'm starting to really learn and subscribe to the idea of, that's the wrong question. The question is, how do I get a manager? How do I get the right manager who is going to be the champion silent partner that's going to bring out the best in my work?
Absolutely. I agree. You know, and for a while, I didn't really think this when I was a development executive, because you're like, oh, I got one more person I got to deal with. But I really believe, you know, having been on the artist side of the table, that, you know, I think a manager, if they're doing what they're supposed to do, which is fundamentally different than what an agent is supposed to do, you know, and the perspective is fundamentally different, then, you know, they're really the person who's like, okay, what kind of agent do we need,
mm-hmm,
at where you are in your career? Absolutely. Oh, okay.
And something else too, like, to bear in mind is, like, I'm not signed right now, but my script Finnegan's has won 2 film festivals and has gotten some reviews on the blacklist. So I've had several management meetings. I'm not going to say with who, because who knows. But they've brought up several times of, like, you know, don't worry, we'll get an agent for you. And here's the other thing. Agents want to get on a fast-moving train. Like, agents want to pick up the train in the middle of the state. I've been pounding on agents' doors. I've been trying to get my stuff to agents. They don't want nothing to do with me. But managers, screenwriters, they're the ones that are actually out there looking for talent. They're the ones that are constantly looking for new clients, new ideas, new people to cultivate. It's, for me, I mean, I'm not even thinking about agents at all. It's all about finding the right manager and the right team, management team, rather. We are coming close, yep, on time, Dal, but I'd love to ask you, okay, real quick. You guys, though, you are now completely have moved all the way over to the side of writing and producing.
Yeah, and directing, yes.
Yes,
absolutely.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
I segued out of management relatively recently, because I have realized what I wanted to do creatively, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in, you know, let's be honest, when I moved to Hollywood, I wanted to tell stories. I mean, my first job in entertainment was I worked as a production accountant. I mean, my very first, I mean, first paying job. I interned a whole bunch, didn't get paid for that. But my first job was as a production accountant. And I remember when I moved to Hollywood, and I hit that point after a few years where I was like, oh, what am I doing? And the woman who had given me my first job, you know, who was really my mentor for a long, long time, and, you know, in that early start of my career, was like, I don't think you ever really wanted to be an accountant. I think there's something else you want to do creatively. And I was always like, I would love to tell stories.
Yeah.
And that's where I am now. I'm at that point where I'm like, I would love to tell stories. And so I've kind of made a decision that I'm going to start telling stories. So that's put me on the artist side of the table.
And, you know, you're co-writing right now, and, you know, but do you find how valuable has, I mean, geez, it's such a loaded question, but like, you know, do you find that your writing and creativity is informed by all the things that you went through from the executive side of the table? Or do you try to forget all that and say, you know something, I'm just going to be the guy under the light bulb?
The answer to that question is yes. And I mean that because I am the guy under the light bulb, and then I laugh at myself and go, oh, that is something I would have told someone not to do.
Right.
I mean, that's the truth of my experience. My experience is I make a lot of the same mistakes that everybody else makes. The difference is, you know, with you know, I put it down, walk away from it, come back a week later and go, oh, geez, Al, you know better than that.
But those are part of the process, though, right? Is that
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Well, this has been just an absolute wealth of information. Dal, I can't thank you enough for sitting and taking the time. And I really hope everybody listening took copious notes. If not, re-listen. Tell all your friends. Great stuff in here for aspiring screenwriters and good reminders for even you seasoned vets. So, M. Dal Walton III, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
Absolutely. And we got a lot of cool, fun stuff coming up. Yes, there will be holiday programming. And yes, there will be some more wrestling programming coming your way. I'm very excited about some possibilities there. And lots more writers and more creative types. Just plenty more of the same. The Handsome Timothy Express is going to be rolling straight into 2015, no problem. So, thanks again for listening, downloading, retweeting. This is Handsome Timmy D on the Handsome Timmy D Express.